So I know as we've gone through the book of Ecclesiastes, some of you may have noted or noticed that some of us say Ecclesiastes, some of us say the preacher, some of us say Kohelet, some of us whatever. Anyway, I just was going to kind of clear that up with a slide. These are all the same person, okay? Kohelet is the Hebrew word, the name of the book. It's interesting, one interesting thing about this is the word appears three times in the first chapter, three times in the last chapter, and once in chapter 7. That's it. So there's probably something to that, but I'll let you guys work that out for yourselves. The word means one who assembles. In this case, the idea is a teacher of the people who brought together proverbs and sayings and refined them and put them together. When they translated the Hebrew to the Greek Old Testament originally, they chose a Greek word, Ecclesiastes, because it means to assemble or to call together. And that's where we get that. That's also, ecclesia is the word for church in the New Testament. So the idea of the teacher, the preacher, then becomes the person who is doing the speaking. If you ever happen to pick up a copy of the Jewish Publication Society Tanakh English Bible, you will find that Kohelet with the K up here is used throughout that. They don't change it to preacher or teacher. They just leave it the same. I like Kohelet, as you probably know. It's what I guess I get used to seeing that in most commentaries and things, so I just got used to using it. So chapter 7, that Marty finished last week, you may remember, is mostly in the form of Proverbs. Now, some English Bibles have all or part of chapter 8 formatted the same way. I'm not sure that's the case with that because other ones don't. They have different paragraphs and things like that. The important thing about the two chapters at this point is they're really about the same topic. They're about wisdom. That's really what Kohelet is describing here. And you may also recall, as we've gone through this, that Kohelet has something of a tortured relationship with wisdom. Back in chapter 1, when he began this quest, the foundation of it was, I applied my heart to seek and search out by wisdom. But he hardly finished that thought before he declared that in much wisdom is vexation. He affirmed in chapter 2 that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly. And in much wisdom, and when there gives strength, wisdom gives strength to the wise man in chapter 7. But then in chapter 7, do not make yourself too wise and destroy yourself. Now, in chapter 7, we got kind of a time in the whole thing here where Kohelet seems to be kind of sitting back and looking at his quest, how things are going, and he summarizes that. All this I have tested by wisdom. I said I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? Then he decided he's going to keep going. He said, I turned my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom and the scheme of things. But, you know, I think there's a little cynicism here in the last part of this verse. To know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness of madness. So we got to appreciate that as we think about Kohelet and how he's doing these things, he's kind of, you know, struggling with all this idea, struggling with what's going on. Now, 8 starts the same topic. Who is like the wise, and who knows the interpretation of a thing? Well, the problem with this is all of the rhetorical questions in Ecclesiastes are answered no. No one is like the wise for this age. No one knows the interpretation or explanation of a thing. And just pick the thing. It's a generic term. But then he follows that up with, a man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed. So what's that mean? Here we go, this back and forth again with Kohelet. But I think we have in this particular discussion of some important things about wisdom and what we need to learn about wisdom in the book of Ecclesiastes. The first part of this proverb is just this question. In fact, some translators put that in previous chapter, put the chapter break a different place, but it can go together with this because it's all the same topic. But these two phrases in the second part are both idioms. They're both Hebrew idioms. So they get translated a little bit differently in some cases, but we know what they mean. The first one, makes his face shine, is the idea of someone coming to an enlightened judgment of some kind, or someone accepting the truth of something that is difficult. I got it. Got to light up. You know that. The second one, the phrase, the hardness of his face, is an idiom that's used for someone who is unwilling to change his behavior, showing pride and self-will and stubbornness. But Kohelet says, wisdom changes that. So we actually have some positive things here about wisdom that are important. But I think what's interesting is that it suggests that the value of wisdom is not in the ability to explain the inexplicable. The value of wisdom is how it changes the person who is trying to contemplate these things. It changes our disposition toward what can't be explained, toward what's difficult to understand. Now, this, I think, is a great place to just take a couple of minutes here and talk about wisdom literature generally in the Old Testament. I'm not sure I said this before doing this, but Ecclesiastes has always been my favorite Old Testament book. And I can go back a long way, and that was my wife will attest. There's something about it that resonates with me. I like Proverbs, too. That's pretty good. And Job, for that matter. Those are kind of your three big wisdom books here. We don't value wisdom in our culture. We're much, much too pragmatic for that. We're all about, you know, how to solve problems, how to make things work. Even as you look at Proverbs, a lot of people, and you find these all throughout. I remember years back, this was something that always kind of put me off about, you guys may remember the basic youth conflicts with Bill Gothard. Of course, that whole organization has fallen on hard times, like so many of them have now. But a lot of what that involved was using Proverbs and using them as kind of a formula for success, or using them as a set of rules for life. That's a very Western, pragmatic way of looking at these things. That's not what was written in the Old Testament. That's not the way the Hebrew mind thinks. That's not what they're interested in. Instead, what you have is in the wisdom literature is these same things, the same ideas, will be presented in different situations with little fine differences or nuances in them. And the idea is that you as the reader, or the one hearing this, you're supposed to take the time to think about those differences and why they're there. Now, we don't do that. In fact, we'd rather have Proverbs organized by topic. It'd be a lot easier to find things, right? But it isn't. It's all scattered all over the place. Now, sometimes these variations that you get are even contradictions. Now, we've seen some of those in Ecclesiastes, and there's a few of those in Proverbs. In fact, the most glaring one of those, my favorite one of those, is in Proverbs 26, verse 4. Some of you may know this. Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. You know what verse 5 says? Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. Which is it? What are we supposed to do? Help! That's the idea. That's what wisdom literature is doing. It's making us stop and think about these things, that, you know what, there may not be one-size-fits-all solution for everything in a given situation. Proverbs itself has a section that really talks about all of wisdom literature. I wanted to just kind of put it up here and read it to remind us what wisdom literature is all about. To know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction in wise dealing, in righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the youth. Let the wise hear and increase in learning, and the one who understands obtain guidance. To understand a proverb and a saying, the words of the wise and their riddles. We all would prefer a clear-cut set of rules or some kind of a decision tree, you know, that you can look at it and say, okay, this is happening, go here, this is happening, go here, this is happening, go here. It always takes us to exactly the right behavior. Exactly the right thing to do. Does life work like that? No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Wisdom in the Bible recognizes that. It addresses these things from all these different ideas and all these different directions, sometimes even the things that seem contradictory, because it recognizes that the problems in life aren't solved by platitudes and simple formulas. In fact, more often than not, biblical wisdom creates tension, and we don't like tension. It's not about knowing how to handle any situation. It's really about accepting that many situations are beyond our understanding. We just don't know how to handle them. We don't know what to do. And it's toward this conclusion that chapter 8 is going to take us, because we're going to talk about it at the end of the chapter as well. So where does he start in this discussion? I say, keep the king's command because of your oath to God. Be not hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand in an evil cause, for he does whatever he pleases. For the word of the king is supreme, and who may say to him, what are you doing? Whoever keeps the command will know no evil thing, and the wise heart will know a proper time and a just way. For there is a time and a way for everything, although man's trouble lies heavy on him. Great example of wisdom literature written right there. He continues his exploration of these things he's talking about by thinking about someone who has access to the king, you know, an advisor or a high court official or a high bureaucratic official of some kind. I've chosen up here, but the italics really is the footnote in the English Standard Version, how to render this, because it's the only English Bible I could find that rendered it this way, the other way. And so I went with this. It attributes the oath to the person in the king's presence, not to God. It's an oath you took in your position here. Now, kings and rulers have been mentioned before in Ecclesiastes. Back in chapter 4, we had a brief reference to a foolish king. In chapter 5, we had a reference to a king who was committed to cultivating fields, keeping people fed. That's a good thing. We have a proverbial statement in chapter 7 that one wise man is more than good than 10 rulers. That's a good one. Kings and rulers will be mentioned again in chapter 9, chapter 10. I think most relevant for chapter 8 is that this appears to be the world that Kohelet lived in. Remember back in chapters 1 and 2, he called himself a king, a ruler. And so he's talking about a world that he really understands, and he's trying to draw some illustrations out of that. We see some a more general description here, maybe, of this kind of authority than you see in the other examples. And so he gives some advice to people in these positions, those people who are close to the levers of power in society. Here's your advice. Not being in too big a hurry to leave the king's presence. Don't know how we would apply that today. Maybe being in too big a hurry to leave after the legislature adjourns. I don't know where to get things done, rush things through, whatever. But the opposite is also going to be true. Don't stay too long. They're both pieces of the same wisdom. Not taking a position to support evil. That's good. That's a good thing to do. Keeping the commands of the king. That's generally something that can be done. But that becomes a little more of a problem if the king chooses to pursue evil and asks you to carry it out. That'd be a little tougher. Hence the importance of this final one of the comments here, that the proper decorum and procedures, there's a way to do these things that's appropriate, and the importance of a way and a time for everything. Chapter 3 was all about that. The words a just way and time were last mentioned together, in fact, in chapter 3, in verses 16 and 17. Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. And I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every manner and every work. On this side of that time for God's judgment, though, even in a royal court, even at the highest levels in the elite in the society or culture, man's trouble lies heavy on him. This would be the case because of the limitations of rulers throughout human history, because they're human. Qohelet continues. For he does not know what is to be. Now, he here could be the king. It could be the king's advisor. I think it could also go back to the phrase, man's troubles, and really be a stand-in for any individual in any situation. For he does not know what is to be done, for who can tell him how it will be? No man has power to retain the spirit or power over the day of death. There is no discharge from war, nor will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. All this I observed while applying my heart to all that is done under the sun when man had power over man to his hurt. Now the first limitation we have here is on those in places of authority involves knowledge of the future. Who has knowledge of the future? Nobody. That's what is one of the challenges that we have. Whenever you come up, you hear an idea or you see something. In fact, one of my favorite things is these kind of futurist books that come out, and they'll say, okay, they look at the world right now, and they project on a line out here and see what it's going to be like and say, this is where we're heading. How many times do those play out the way they're expected? It's because things don't move in a straight line very well. Too many people involved. That makes sure it stays messy and kind of wanders around a little bit. And so you end up with things that you didn't even think were going to happen. No one knows the future. And to think that you do, or to think you can predict it, or to act as if we can make something happen is really pretty foolish. The second limitation involves power itself. And that's in verse 8. There are two kind of general translation approaches to this verse. One treats the phrases as sort of connected, each part, two halves of two phrases. And the New International does this. It takes the approach by connecting the paraphrases with something like as this, then this, or so this. Most English translations just kind of treat them like bullet points. They just one after the other. So the first bullet point is no human can retain the spirit. Now that's the Hebrew word ruah. Besides being a good wine made by desert wind, is also a word that means wind or life's breath or spirit. A lot of English translations, most of them actually say no one can restrain the wind. The same idea that we have in striving after wind, shepherding the wind, we've seen in Ecclesiastes. This is followed by the next bullet point, no human has power over the day of death. Well, I guess you could argue that, you know, somebody could choose to disprove that by going out and killing somebody or themselves. I guess that's an option too in this. But that's not really what we're getting at here. What it means is that God knows the day of a person's death, and no amount of human intervention is going to change that day. Next, no human gets a discharge from war. Well, what's that mean? It's kind of a challenging Hebrew text. You get lots of variations on this one. I think it makes the most sense to take this as a metaphor relating to the inevitability of death. In this sense, it's the kind of the war or the battle or the struggle that we go through in life on the way to death. The struggle between life and death. Finally, no human given to wickedness will avoid the consequences. They're going to be there. eventually. Now, I think the New Living Translation does a nice job of conveying this, so I thought I'd just kind of put it up here for comparison. None of us can hold back our spirit from departing. None of us has the power to prevent the day of our death. There is no escaping that obligation, that dark battle, and in the face of death, wickedness will certainly not rescue the wicked. Some good wisdom there. Verse 9 makes two important general observations about ruling authorities or government. And to understand that, I want to actually kind of use this opportunity, because I mentioned before, I believe, that a lot of the view of the world that Qohelet has, you can find anchored in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. When you read those chapters, you find that God has done this great work of creation. And when he's done with it, he can declare it good. But it doesn't take long before the most important of God's creation, humanity, brings a curse on everything through their rebellion against the Creator. After chapter 3 in Genesis, it ends up being pretty much about death and dysfunction. Just like a lot of the observations of Ecclesiastes are about that. Genesis 9, God told Noah, "From his fellow man I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image." Now, most scholars who look seriously at the Bible as things that are truth we need to know, view this as the institution of human government. This is when that institution was set up. There's some kind of power that man has over man. Ruling authorities exist by virtue of God's appointment, and they wield a coercive power. That's what makes them government. That's what makes them rulers. That's affirmed by the Old Testament, the New Testament. We hit that a couple times in 1 Peter. We did it recently. By the time you get to Genesis 11, this human institution set up by God, though, has manifested itself in the dysfunction of trying to attempt to build a city with a tower with its top in the heavens. Those of you who are C.S. Lewis fans may know the title of Book 3 of the Space Trilogy is taken from David Lindsay, a 16th century Scottish poet, who described the Tower of Babel as that hideous strength, a symbol of mankind's aspiration to be like God, is a hideous strength. It will always turn out in hideous ways. The second observation is that an institution intended to curb the sin of humanity, which is what it was originally set up, would be used to hurt humanity. Qohelet had no illusions about human nature. He made it clear from the beginning that what is crooked cannot be made straight, what is lacking cannot be counted. This is restated in chapter 7, in fact, even in a stronger form, where it says, "Consider the work of God, who can make straight what he has made crooked." This is the reality of life in a fallen world. No corner of creation is exempt from the effects of the curse brought on it by the sinfulness of mankind. Thus, Qohelet can conclude that his discussion by the kings by calling attention to this coercive power that was supposed to be used positively, but it's often used negatively, and it's baked right into the cake of government. There will always be those in authority who will use that power to the harm of others. You don't believe that? Read a history book. The type of government may reduce the potential for doing harm, but it will never get rid of it. As long as the positions of power are occupied by human beings, putting your hope in the government to solve anything will be a disappointment. That's our big lesson, I think, to learn from that. Appropriate, coming up to the 4th of July. It's a great thing. We have one of the better government forms in the world as far as reducing harm, but you know what? It's still got people running it. Kohelet already declared that surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and who never sins, back in chapter 7. And there he echoes really his predecessor David, who wrote in the Psalms, "The Lord looks down from heaven on the children of man to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. They have all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is no one who does good, not even one." Now, as he considered all these abuses and institutions and things, it brought Kohelet, kind of led him to another observation here. There's no real pattern to these. These are just kind of musings as he's going through these things. This is kind of long and somewhat complicated. Then I saw the wicked buried. They used to go in and out of the holy place. They were praising the city where they had done such things. This also is vanity, because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily. The heart of the children of man is fully set to do evil. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God, because they fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, neither will he prolong his days like a shadow, because he does not fear before God. There is a vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I say that this also is vanity. Now, actually, this is one, believe it or not reaching, that you can make more sense out of it as a chiasm. Remember, the pairs are parallel, all right? They comment each other. So the first verse in this, "And I saw the wicked buried." They had gone doing in and out of the holy place. They were praising the city where they had done these things, done the wicked things, not the going in and out. It's the wicked things being referred to there. This is also vanity. So down at the end, there is a vanity, all right? Here we have the same, similar kind of statement that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. And the wicked seem to get away with things. The next pair, "Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily, the heart of the children of man," or literally the children of Adam, "is fully set to do evil." Okay, there's a principle, right? We could do a sermon on that probably. But it will not be well with the wicked, neither will he prolong his days like a shadow, because he does not fear before God. So this idea of prolonging his days like a shadow, you got to remember that whenever the word shadow is used, look it up sometime, do a word study on it in the Old Testament, and when it talks about life, it's talking about how fleeting life is. It's like a shadow, it just fades away. So he doesn't get away with that. He will be judged. And he will be judged apparently in some way, that there's some way in which the wicked will not flourish after death. We aren't told that in Ecclesiastes, but there's the implication of that. The central point, though, of this, then, is in the middle. "Though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God, because they fear before him." Almost an optimistic statement from Kohelet here. We need to take note of that. The fear of God is after death, will somehow be involved in some sort of a flourishing. We don't know the details again. So this idea of fear is important, kind of the central set, vanity to the outer set. Another part of this that I think is helpful is that, just to look at real quick, is the word vanity, which we've seen many times here now. We looked at the definitions before, but we got to add another one now: incomprehensible, enigma. One of the sad things is English translations, and when you understand how they do this, they always take the same Hebrew word and translate it the same way. So it's going to be vanity, meaningless, futility. There's not another way to do this. But if you're a native speaker of Hebrew, and you see the word hevel, and you see it in these contexts, they tend to build the context a little bit more. It means all these things: ephemeral, transitory, absurd, emptiness, useless, and idle. But it's also an enigma. It's hard to understand. The New English Translation actually translates it that way. I put that up there just because I thought it was interesting to see it, how it would look. Kohelet understood, that this reverse of fortune between the righteous and the wicked didn't make any sense. this didn't seem to be the way that things should happen. Now, we're looking at a time where he knows Deuteronomy. He knows the curses and the promises that go with the obeying and disobeying God, the blessings and the curses. And, of course, many principles and proverbs look like they read like that as well. You do this thing will be a result. And so it's enigmatic to him, or incomprehensible to him, that the world doesn't more strictly conform to the action-consequence pattern of God's promises. Why is that? Why doesn't it? Now, he's already complained, just to recount a few of these, about this. He talks about oppressions and the tears of the oppressed. On the side of the oppressors there was power. He talked about in chapter 5 the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness. And in chapter 7 he talks about a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness and a wicked man who prolongs his life by his evil doing. These things don't seem to be right. They don't seem to be what is supposed to happen. Kohelet understood the law. It said obedience, following the rules, is supposed to result in blessing. Yet too often the wicked prevail, and when they should not, the righteousness suffer. Why? It takes wisdom to answer that question. It's an enigma. It's a puzzle that maybe cannot be solved. Why should we expect anything else from life under the sun? I think is the question we need to be asking ourselves here. It's a fallen world. It's a cursed world. Theologian Peter Lighthart has a great summary of this, I think. He's talking about Ecclesiastes. He wrote, "We don't yet see God putting everything right. We don't see the sovereign hand of poetic justice. Innocents die. Sages are ignored. Moral pygmies ruin the airwaves and the movie screens of many nations. That's what it's like to live in a world of vapor." And that's just what we should expect once we wake from our modern nap and realize we are creatures made from dust, living in a world made from nothing at all. On what were we drunk when we began to imagine we could figure it all out? Hubris is what we're drunk on, mostly. Pride, thinking we can do anything. I think even more important to this is, what does this tell us about the gospel message we should be taking out? I think we have to really be careful that we don't preach the gospel or share the gospel or to communicate it with the idea that it's a fix for everything under the sun, because it's not. Now, the health and wealth preachers make precisely that the point of their gospel, which is both the appeal and the error of their message. The church was born with suffering on a cross, and Jesus never promised his followers they would not suffer. In fact, he said exactly the opposite: you will suffer. In a book on biblical theology of suffering, D.A. Carson wrote, "The truth of the matter is that all we have to do is live long enough and we will suffer." But this is by design, because, as Carson later noted, the staying power of our faith is neither demonstrated nor developed until it is tested by suffering. When sin and death entered the world in Genesis 3, God determined that the crooked would not be made straight until all of creation will be redeemed. That hasn't happened yet. In the meantime, we're stuck with life under the sun. But as he's done before, even Kohelet finds a little solace, a little positive point in what's going on here. "And I commend joy, for there is nothing good under the sun for man than to eat and drink and be joyful, for this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun." The phrase "there is nothing good" in here, we first saw in the first of these, what are called carpe diem statements, seize the day statements or passages in Ecclesiastes. We now have five of the seven that are in there. And I think it's important to note that they progressively look at things a little more emphatically and a little more positively. In chapter 5, Qohelet moved beyond the simple description of the statements or passages in chapters 2 and 3 by calling these things fitting and good, or good and fitting. Now in chapter 8, he adds, I command joy in these things. When we get to the last two Carpe Diem statements, they won't be suggestions, they'll be commands. Joy is to be found in the simple activities of eating, drinking, and working. When all five statements are considered that we have so far, we also see that these things are a gift from God. They are an allotment or a portion given to each person living under the sun. And beginning with the statements in chapter 3, to rejoice becomes part of the formula. The only other place the three verbs, to eat, to drink, and to rejoice, are used in the New Testament is in Deuteronomy 14 in a discussion of worship. One commentator noted that Qohelet calls us to eat, drink, and enjoy life. When he does that, he is like Moses calling us to worship. Worship begins with thanksgiving, for that is what God has provided, for what he has provided, these things, these simple things. And thanksgiving is only truly possible when we are guided by a wisdom that acknowledges the limitations of humanity. We can't know it all, but we can know these things. I think it's not without plan that when you look ahead to when things of heaven and earth are finally redeemed, what's the first thing that happens? Marriage supper of the Lamb. We're going to eat, drink, and be joyful. What has been suggested so far in chapter 8 is now stated very clearly. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, how neither day nor night do one's eyes see sleep, then I saw all the work of God that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. Trying to understand all that is done on earth, all that is done under the sun, will just result in sleepless nights. It is a work of God, and by definition, beyond our capacity. We should know that. That's pretty simple. No amount of toil in seeking will change this, no matter how hard you work, no matter how much you memorize. And if anyone claims to know, don't believe them. They can't. One of my favorite quotes from the Reformation theologian John Calvin is, "The human mind is a perpetual forge of idols." When Calvin wrote those words in the 16th century, he lived in a culture that found it virtually impossible not to believe in God. And so those idols Calvin anticipated there were those objects outside of the person that competed with God. In stark contrast, a growing segment of our contemporary culture finds it virtually impossible to think that anyone could believe in God. Deeply rooted in individualism and self-autonomy, our minds and our hearts don't produce idols anymore. They are the idols. We are told we can be who or whatever we want to be. We're told there are no limits. But chasing the modern idol of self runs smack into where Ecclesiastes started. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity, a striving after wind. People try to ignore the truth of the human condition by distracting themselves. Do that with ceaseless activity. You can do that with entertainment. You can get high on grievances and anger. A lot of that going on right now in our culture. You can accumulate a bunch of stuff, lots of toys to distract you. Others try dulling themselves with drugs and alcohol, or retreating into a virtual world where they can live the fantasy of control over the universe, but it's only the size of their view screen. Of course, there's always the time-honored option of resignation, stoically accepting sometimes tragic fate, but try to keep from sliding into despair with a position like that. In his relentless and restless examination of life under the sun, Kohelet exposes the impossibility of trying to control or even understand it. But in this, he challenges us to broaden our notion of wisdom. Maybe wisdom involves more than having all the answers. Maybe we really don't have the control over our lives that we've been led to believe. Christian psychologist Larry Crabb wrote, and I really appreciate this, I may have shared it before, "The simple fact we must face is this: something is wrong with everything. No matter how closely we walk with the Lord, we cannot escape the impact of a disappointing and sometimes evil world. A core sadness that will not go away is evidence not of spiritual maturity, but of honest living in a sad world." That core sadness, interestingly enough, is perfectly compatible with joy in the things that God has given us. And even more so for those of us who have embraced the gospel of King Jesus, where we have this thing we can look forward to. Wisdom literature, like Ecclesiastes, is important, and I think the importance lies in it anchors our perspective in realities of life in a fallen world. It rids us of illusions about life under the sun and compels us to look more consistently beyond this life for us to our blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ. Let's pray.